Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. August 9th is the 40th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard M. Nixon, and a gentleman who probably knows more about the events that led up to his resignation, at least a gentleman who is still living, is joining us on the program today to talk about that. His name is John Dean. Welcome to the program, sir.
He's very much alive.
John, you've got this new book out that's come out just in time for this 40th anniversary of the Nixon resignation.
And that wasn't an accident.
It's called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. What a project.
It was. You know, Vic, had I known going in, I would not have taken it on. And I really was about 6, 8, 10 months into it before I realized I had to go dig out and first catalog all of his Watergate conversations that he'd recorded, and then I had to transcribe them. The reason I hadn't realized it, I figured all the key conversations somebody else had already transcribed, and when I got into it, I found no one either had made a catalog of all the conversations, and that most of the transcripts that were out were all partial transcripts, and I needed to know everything to answer the question of that started the whole thing, which was how could anybody as intelligent and politically savvy as Richard Nixon let what happened to his presidency happen? And it just, one tape led to the other, and I had to finally go back and do them all. And it turned out there were about 1,000 conversations, maybe 600 of which nobody has probably outside the National Archives ever listened to. So the book is chock full of new information. It's not a book of transcripts, of course, but it became the basis for the narrative and dialogue.
This reads like a Greek tragedy, but there are also some elements of bizarre humor. It's like a Greek tragedy meeting the Keystone Cops.
Well, it's true. The stumbling and bumbling was somewhat startling to me. But there's no question that there's tragedy. But there's also, to my surprise, Nixon, who I thought was probably one of the most skilled administrators and men we could ever have in that office, given his years as vice president, is not that. His mistakes are highly apparent when you go through this material. He just refuses to face facts. Initially, he doesn't want all the facts. Then when he wants them, his top aides, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, don't give him all the information. And then when he starts getting the information and knows where there's more, he doesn't want it. When he gets in trouble, he really doesn't want to understand the facts. So some of this is all of his own making, and that part of it really kind of surprised me that for example, he fashions much of his final defense around our March 21st conversation when I told him there was a cancer on his presidency. And he will claim in that last defense that, well, he knew nothing of the Watergate cover-up until I had come in and told him on March 21st. Well, of course, that was untrue. But even the conversation itself, the March 21st conversation, which he never listens to, he listened to other conversations with me, but he just takes Haldeman, who he has listened to it once, and you can't listen to these conversations once and get it all. But when the conversation came out, it puts the lie to his very claim that he didn't know anything before, because there are all kinds of extenuating lead-ins in that conversation that certainly suggest he had much more knowledge than he claimed in his defense.
John Dean joins us. His book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. You went through and you figured there were 37 different instances when you and President Nixon talked about Watergate.
That's right. They weren't all recorded, but there were, well, a number of them were, but not all of them. But we had 37 conversations. He doesn't talk to me about Watergate until, really, truly, until 8 months after the arrests of the Watergate burglars. That's one of the things that surprises me. He gets all of his initial information just from principally Haldeman and Ehrlichman and the newspapers. And that's all he wants. Then when he wants more, as I said earlier, they deny him that information. So he's partially informed, but he's also intimately involved with the cover-up from day one.
I thought it was fascinating that there's so many instances where he would read his morning paper, he'd be reading the Washington Post, and that's when he would find out what was going on in his own administration.
That's very true. And I suspect that's true of all presidents in some degree. We had a recent incident where the CIA did not inform President Obama of the surveillance of the Germans when he's about to call the German prime minister. and I'm sure she knew much more than he did, but a couple days later it came out in the paper and he learned the full story. Their staff does hear stuff, but it's not easy to get it all into a president. But with Watergate, he knew, one of the odd things is that because of a prior scandal called the ITT scandal, which had been really a bogus scandal in many regards. It was a claim that the ITT Corporation had paid $100,000, or in the story, $400,000, to San Diego as a quid pro quo for the Republicans holding their convention there, and they were settling an antitrust case with ITT, which was untrue. But yet much was made of that in the spring of 73, and the Nixon White House just really went after it. Well, Nixon thought there was such an overreaction to ITT that other things didn't get done. A lot of government work got pushed aside for the politics of all this. And the scandal, they really couldn't handle the scandal, really didn't go away. The Democrats made good hay out of this. And so as a result of ITT, when Watergate happens, he takes this is one that needed his attention, needed the full attention of the White House, and he plays it down. He says, I don't want to do with Watergate what we did with ITT. And so while this Watergate needed attention, and a hard, honest treatment, he doesn't give it because he thought they overreacted to ITT.
And if he'd been paying attention, he would have known about Howard Hunt and his red wig and funny glasses interviewing Dita Byrd.
Dita Byrd, yes, indeed, he would have. This stuff slowly trickles into him, but as I say, you're right, he learns a lot of it from the newspaper. While the newspaper is never ahead of the investigators, and there is a certain myth about the role of the Washington Post, which was vital to Watergate and its unraveling, but they did not crack the case, and they really were never very far ahead of or ever really truly ahead of investigators. What they got were good leaks, and we now know that one of their principal sources was Mark Felt, who was Deep Throat, Bob Woodward's key source, and Felt was the number two man in the FBI and for all practical purposes running the Watergate investigation from day to day.
It seems apparent from reading about Felt that he is Deep Throat throughout the story that you tell in your book. I mean, this guy had his own agenda, and we never knew who Deep Throat was until just in the last couple of years. But it seems clear, based on his behavior when you're talking about it, that he had to be Deep Throat.
It's on the tapes. We knew he was leaking. We didn't at that time know of a Deep Throat character. This really doesn't come out until after Woodward and Bernstein write the book, All the President's Men, to learn that Woodward's source has been dubbed Deep Throat after the porn movie by one of the senior editors at the Post. He's somebody that Bob just Woodward talked about working with on deep background, which means you can't quote them, you can't do anything with them. They were just confirming sources. But there's Felt was giving information to a lot of people before he gave it to Woodward. Woodward wasn't one of his prime sources. He was Time Magazine, he got better information from Felt than Woodward did. newspapers. There was a local daily at that time that he fed a lot of information to. So yes, I never hooked it up and connected them after it came out, because there's a problem with if you look at Woodward's book, All the President's Men, Deep Throat first talks to him on the 19th of June, right after the arrests. And the last time they talk is the first week of November of 1973. Well, the problem is Mark Felt left the FBI in May of 73. And there's just no way he could have had really the information. So while Bob always told me all the clues would fit, that one certainly doesn't. It was big enough for me never to buy into Felt being possible as the person. So he may have given some disinformation to try to keep people off the trail.
John Dean joins us. His book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Richard M. Nixon resigned as our president 40 years ago. John, we probably have a few listeners out there who are from the current generation who don't know who Richard Nixon was, and they don't know who you are. Why don't you give them a little brief bio? How did you get involved in the Nixon administration? What was your role?
Well, I don't join the White House until Nixon's elected in 68, becomes president in January of 69, and I was asked to join his Department of Justice, where I became the Associate Deputy Attorney General. I'd been on Capitol Hill as a minority counsel to the House Judiciary Committee, and was actually kind of surprised when they asked me to come over to the White House. John Ehrlichman had been Nixon's initial White House counsel. I was very young. I was in my early 30s and was not looking for the job. In fact, my boss, John Mitchell, advised me not to go to the White House to work. He said, you know, you'll go up the ranks here. I was already about the number 13th man ranking in the Department of Justice and enjoyed the Justice Department greatly. But anyway, I was asked by the president to come over when Ehrlichman became his head domestic policy advisor. And the job really wasn't terribly well defined and kind of evolved. A lot of it was things like technical things like clearing people for conflict of interest. Various legislative issues had to be addressed. It's the liaison between the White House and the Department of Justice, where I'd worked, for when you need. And that's really the president's law firm, is the Department of Justice, particularly and specifically the Office of Legal Counsel. The head of that office was Bill Rehnquist at the time, later Chief Justice, after being an Associate Justice. So I think they brought me over because I knew how Washington worked. I knew how Capitol Hill worked. I actually think that's one of the problems that befronted a lot of his staff during Watergate, is they did not know how Washington worked. Richard Nixon certainly did, but there was a certain naivete about what happens and how things get sorted out in Washington. People like John Ehrlichman really did not have a lot of goodwill to go around when they got themselves in trouble. But anyway, I joined it in 70, so I'm there long before Watergate. But I have only really incidental. I'm just a middle level staff lawyer, and that's pretty much where the White House counsel has always been, even after I left. In fact, I've known most of the people who filled that job, and there's a former Illinois congressman by the name of Admiral Mikva, who I knew from working on Capitol Hill, and he became a federal court of appeals judge and stepped down from his judgeship, a lifetime appointment, to become one of Bill Clinton's counsel. And I think that Mikva, based on conversations with him, thought he was going to be sort of a day-to-day advisor of the president, but found himself in this middle-level slot and didn't stay there real long, and probably realized he'd given up a hell of an appointment to become White House counsel. So it's an important, actually in one of the tapes in the book, Haldeman makes the point to Nixon. He says, you know, you don't think this job is very important for counsel. And he said, it isn't, except when something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. And then you were sucked into the vortex and you got more and more responsibility. And you didn't know that President Nixon was taping all these conversations. In fact, only Nixon and Haldeman of the inner circle knew. And it seems apparent that both of them are performing for the tape recorder in a number of spots.
Yes, that's true. I don't think there's any question that they knew it. In fact, that's how they tipped me off eventually, that there is a recording. Ehrlichman does not know it. Kissinger does not know it. And Colson does not know it. Other people who wander in and out of this book that I've done. But it's clear also that Nixon and Haldeman forget about it at times and have conversations. But I think some of the really rough conversations, I noted this in the book at the end when they're working out how Haldeman is going to testify, particularly about the conversation on March 21st where he was on the tail end of it. Haldeman says, let's meet in the Lincoln sitting room in the residence where he knew that was not recorded. The only recording equipment there was on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So they're conscious of it when they realize they need to be conscious about it. But there's clearly evidence in some of the conversations where they're quite aware of it. But as I say, just sort of the day-to-day operation, particularly early in the aftermath of Watergate all those tapes that were never transcribed, that I put in, say, my part 2, 3 of the book, they're sort of oblivious to it if they're aware of it.
John, you're one of the actors in this national drama as it's unfolding on the pages of your book, and it's all chronological. We're going day by day, meeting by meeting. You're putting all the information together, all of this extensive conversation where you're walking into an office, you're walking out of an office. You say Haldeman came in 30 minutes later, Ehrlichman left, this guy came through, another guy left. And it's just this constant performance where we're hearing them telling all these lies. Nixon's pretending he doesn't know something. Haldeman is equivocating. Ehrlichman is playing dumb. And you're walking into an office, you're walking out of an office, and then years later, you're listening to the tapes, and you're hearing them talking about you. They're talking about your sex life, or Nixon saying, referring to you, he's a crook, he's a snake. And he says it with admiration.
Well, that's some pretty amazing stuff. As you can see, I did not hold back. If it was there, I put it in the book, in the narrative or the dialogue. I guess my reaction, some of it I did occasionally take my headset off and say, holy cow. But I know how the story turned out. So,
uh-huh.
That's one of the reasons I thought, I was also able to hear things on these tapes that other people can't hear. When on the publication of the book, we posted on a website what's called the Appendix C, and in that appendix, which is not in the book itself, there's a reference to it in the preface. People can actually go and find the various tape conversations online. They're virtually all of them, other than the ones in Part 1 of the book, are now available at the Nixon Library. So they can hear this stuff themselves.
Mm.
And the tapes are of varying degrees of quality. Some of them are the telephone conversations, they're almost broadcast quality. The Oval Office and Camp David are pretty good. It depends if people are seated near the desk where the microphones were buried. Then it's pretty good. Nixon tends to get away from that microphone. I don't think he knew actually where it was, but particularly when he put his feet up on the desk, he's pretty far back from it, and his legs are kind of blocking the range of the microphone. But so the Oval Office can be tough, but you get a knack for listening to these, and they're all digitized now. That's one of the things. I was ahead of the archives and got I digitized all those I was able to get access to, which was virtually all of them, and digitized them before the archives even had. And that way you can tweak them a little bit, and while it distorts the voice, you can, for transcription purposes, you can do it. And it makes it a little easier to do. But you, through repetitive listening, you can slowly make out the gist of what's being said. So we got most of it. And the EOB office, and I think there's some real confusion in Holloman and Ehrlichman's mind about whether the system is there in some of the conversations. It is, but, you know, they're not clear. Nixon particularly, in some conversations in December of 72, they don't think it's operating over there for some reason.
Hmm.
And this seems to be why they might have some of the more candid conversations there. But it's amazing listening to this stuff all these years later. And hearing what they had to say about me. Nixon is also very flattering. He thinks the world of me. And obviously, that will change when I break rank and refuse to lie for him.
Yes, he certainly does change his tune and eventually asks you basically to take a fall for him.
Not in some
with a letter of resignation.
Yes, he does. He doesn't know how to handle me because I make it pretty clear I'm not going to lie. I'm very upfront with them about my process of breaking rank, where I have one foot in each camp initially, where I tell them I'm going to hire a lawyer, I'm going to send that lawyer down to the prosecutor's office, see what's involved in cooperating and ending this thing, because I'm naive enough at that point to believe that they'll all do the right thing, that, you know, that just somebody, you know, starting the process, I think, will start others to say, well, yeah, we have made mistakes. Let's just go in and take the medicine, and that's what we should have done. And Nixon might have survived if everybody had done it, including him being candid about, you know, I didn't realize I was getting across the line. I didn't know what obstruction of justice was. So, you know, I think candor could have, you know, prevailed. In fact, there never should have been a cover-up in the first place. Had he not had his rather strange view of what a cover-up is, and he keeps, if you recall, he keeps saying, well, we can't cover this up. That's where we'll get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how during the Truman administration, when he was on Capitol Hill, that's how he nailed Truman, was because of the cover-up. Well, in this instance, what he thinks a cover-up is if the men who were caught at the Watergate offices of the DNC and were arrested, and their immediate superiors who had left tracks all over, Hunt and Liddy, as well as the burglars, if they got a pass, that was a cover-up. But blocking the investigation from getting to Magruder and Mitchell, who'd approved this operation, that's not a cover-up. That's just he doesn't say what that is, but he thinks as long as they're not going to completely whitewash it and nobody be prosecuted for anything, that's not a cover up. So it's an evolving understanding he has that yes, indeed, it is a cover up too to have those who were responsible for developing this idea and instructing these people to go in there and paying them money. That's part of the cover-up.
There were so many dirty tricks going on, and it seems like Charles Colson took a lot of those secrets to his grave. But I'm wondering, was this bunch of buffoons that broke into Ellsberg's doctor's office and tried to do the Watergate thing, were they also involved, do you think, when George Wallace was shot and they broke into the attempted assassin's apartment, Walter Bremer, and dumped a bunch of McGovern campaign literature? Do you think it was the same bunch of clowns?
Well, I don't. They tried to get Hunt to do that. Colson tried to get Hunt to do that. And Hunt was just too leery of it. That was the plan to have that done, but there really it was never done, is my understanding. That Hunt just was too reluctant to do it. But it was not beyond Colson and Nixon to cook this up and have it something like that done, because Wallace was a threat to them.
Well, apparently Roger Stone has a book coming out where he makes the claim that Nixon, through Alexander Haig, tried to make a deal with Gerry Ford about a pardon in exchange for information that Nixon knew supposedly the CIA had been involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, I think we can go pretty far with our conspiracy theories, but...
Well, I don't know Roger Stone. I know who he is, and he claims much more knowledge and relationship with the Nixon administration than he ever had. Conspiracy buffs are out there cooking this stuff up. It was a real conspiracy, and I have hard tapes to show it. You don't need to fantasize this stuff. The record, this puts to sleep that kind of crazy speculation, because these guys, while they are aware of the taping system, I mean, the remarkable stuff that Nixon says on the tapes that is really guilty knowledge. I mean, he clearly knows that he's done things that are improper, and that's why he doesn't want his tapes to come out. He's also done things that show he's incompetent, which is probably another reason he didn't want the tapes coming out. But these conspiracy theories just don't fly, and that's why another reason, once I started this project, I said, I've got to go through every one of these conversations, because there's stuff that precedes them, that follows them, and what have you. And they're a remarkable record. Had that kind of thing gone on, it would have slipped out in a conversation, or there would be a reference to it, because they talk in code at times, and yet, and I'm pretty good at deciphering that code, and there's none of that, these kind of way out theories that people are throwing around, the Roger Stones of the world. So who knows? That's an effort, a quick buck, not to sort out this history.
Sure.
So I can't even take it seriously.
Well, John, this is an amazing thing that you've done. The book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean has been my guest, and when you read the book, you'll discover that John was supposed to write a report about Watergate, but somehow it just never was written. It never came about. But John, I've got to give it to you. You've finally written your report.
And I'm sure Nixon would be unhappy with it, as he would if I'd written it at the time.
I'm sure he would. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been John Dean. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.